The word paramita, the primary kind of etymology or meaning of the word, is that which is highest or ultimate. And that which is of the highest value for our hearts, highest value for our innate goodness, for our expression of freedom. And perhaps as ideals or high values, it might be easy to understand it for five of the six paramitas: generosity. Without generosity, there would be no society. There'd probably be no you, no life that we know it. The degree of generosity that exists in our society far outweighs the degree to which is opposite, in spite of what the newspapers say. The news says, in spite of what the news highlights. I saw this so well in raising children, not only becoming aware of the tremendous generosity of the network of parents that I saw all over, and how much our society, local society, does generously to try to create a good environment for children, the amount of volunteering that goes on. It's really amazing. And it might be easy to see how sila, or virtue, is a high value, especially when we understand it to be connected to not harming. The value of creating a society, living in a society where there's no, we don't harm each other, where we care for each other, where they're concerned with the greatest good for all of us. And it might be possible to see that patience in all its forms is a great value. Without giving ourselves patient time for things to grow and unfold and develop, maybe many of the important things would never develop. The farmer who tugs on the plant so it grows faster destroys the plant. And it might be possible to see that effort is of high value, because nothing is really accomplished without some kind of effort. And that to engage and persist and be involved in our lives, in some ways, is our lives. There's no life, perhaps, without some kind of effort, some doing, some engagement. And it might be possible to see that the last paramita, wisdom, is of high value. Seems like wisdom is something that's applicable and useful, if it's wisdom, everywhere we go, and to live a wise life. The Buddha's definition of a wise person is someone who is concerned with the welfare of themselves, of others, and both themselves and others. And if that's what wisdom is, that's pretty good for everyone, including yourself. But this one that today, the Sanskrit word is dhyana, And it's possible it should just be translated as concentration, but in Buddhist language, jhana is the same as in Pali, jhana, which means deep meditative absorption. There are four states, classically four jhanas, sometimes eight, but classically four. And for many people, they're not accessible. They're not something that is available for many people in most of their life, ordinary life. Even people who go on retreat, it's not necessarily available to drop into these deep states of absorption. And to, you know, so is this a universal value? Is this a highest value to attain these states that many people can't attain? And what is it? Why is this particular factor a paramita? So of course, I don't have a clue what the people came up with this list we're thinking about. And I can't speak about the origins of the word and the idea, and I could speak a little bit about, you know, maybe what I think it can mean or an application of it all. And when I try to think of how jhana has ultimate value, a number of things come up for me. But one is that it's likely that it's just an alternative way of saying samadhi. And the word samadhi appears in many lists. Samadhi is a little broader concept than jhana, though samadhi often points towards, in Buddhism, towards jhana. But I like the word samadhi quite a bit. In India, it's a very important, powerful word in India, in many of the Indian religious traditions. And in some traditions, samadhi is held up as kind of the equivalent of the Buddhist nirvana, kind of the ultimate state of liberation and freedom. And, and to translate samadhi as concentration really narrows the meaning of it in a way that kind of, I don't know, to translate samadhi as concentration kind of makes it much smaller than it is, or dehumanizes it, or desacralizes it. Because I associate the word samadhi with, it's almost like sacred, kind of something that has some kind of sacred value. And one of the ways I understand the sacredness of samadhi is that samadhi is a state of being at peace with ourselves, to have no conflict, to have the heart, the mind settled, not because it's been forced to settle down, but because it's no longer fighting anything, no longer afraid, no longer lusting after something, but is really kind of, the mind is at peace, settled, not agitated. I think of samadhi as kind of sacred because I think I associate it with an awareness which does not exclude anything. An awareness is able to include everything within it. And as soon as we exclude something from awareness, like, oh, I can't pay attention to that, that doesn't count, that shouldn't be in awareness, then awareness is not sacred, because somehow sacred is awareness which allows everything, allows for wholeness and openness, and receptivity and inclusivity of everything. And so samadhi is not a state of not being in conflict or not being fighting anything, not struggling. Another way of talking about it is an awareness that includes everything. It doesn't mean that we don't say no or stop some things, But we don't stop it in awareness. We don't stop it in our hearts. Our hearts are open to enough to hold everything. And our wisdom, hopefully, knows what to say yes and what to say no to in practically. But we keep our awareness open. So for me, at least, you know, I have this almost sacred or association of sacredness in the word samadhi. And it's interesting then to look at our minds, to see how it operates, see what goes on in there. And to see, for example, how much of the time, maybe in daily life, the mind is directed outward. Maybe directed into the future, thinking of planning and wanting, and or how often the mind is directed in the past with regrets or concerns. Or the mind is kind of lost in, I don't quite understand what it is yet. It's part of never really knew parts of popular culture, especially what goes on TV. But so maybe I'm misunderstanding, but you know, sometimes we say our mind's involved in fantasy, but maybe it's involved in reality TV. Is it really real with reality TV? I don't know how it works. But, you know, we were lost in fantasy. And so it's churning and agitated and preoccupied. Sometimes it's kind of a centrifugal force going out of itself into its concerns. And the common mind, the common mental activity and thinking is to be concerned about something. So you could say, I'm thinking about plans for tonight. I'm thinking about what happened at breakfast. I'm thinking about my next walking period. I'm thinking about, you know, so you can say about, you could describe it that way. I'm thinking about something. And usually the mind is preoccupied with aboutness, which is a little bit removed, or maybe quite removed, from being really right here, living, and feeling, experiencing, engaging our life as it is. And it can be very removed sometimes. And it can, of course, it can be very compelling to live in a mind of thoughts and plans and ideas, and worries and fears. And sometimes it's very compelling because it's very pleasant and enjoyable. Sometimes it's very engaging because it's we have fear, and so we're trying to protect ourselves and care for ourselves and take care of all the situations. Sometimes it's engaging because we have important issues in our life to take care of, and we believe if we think about them enough, we'll get the solution. And sometimes we do. And so we kind of look and we're trying to figure things out. And sometimes it's engaging because it's a way of building up ourselves. It's a way of reinforcing a certain self-concept, some way we want to see ourselves or represent ourselves. And so we build this whole edifice of self and self-understanding. And or we're trying to build something. We're not just thinking about things because those things are interesting, but those things are about, some ways reflect back to us and what we're trying to do for ourselves and create a sense of self. And so it's compelling to have these kinds of thoughts. But it's also tiring. It's also stressful. And it's the tiring and stressful nature of the churning thinking mind is one that becomes pretty obvious on a silent retreat. And I know I've sat sometimes and spent, you know, a few hours. Probably the longest time I spent lost in fantasy was 3 days on retreat. That's pretty good. You want to do something thoroughly. And so And then sooner or later, it's like, what am I doing? Actually, the longest bout probably was, it wasn't just nonstop. The 3 days was kind of more or less nonstop. I couldn't stop it. But 1 year at the Tassajara, the Zen monastery, was recurring. Pretty much every time we had a meal, I had fantasies about being made what's called a guest cook the following summer, because I'd been a cook in the kitchen for a whole year, and I was convinced they were going to make me a guest cook the following summer. So it's kind of a high prestige role at Zen Center, kind of, I thought. So I spent all these meals, you know, they serve you, I'd sit there, eat, and kind of analyzing the menu and the food and planning what I was going to do and how great it was going to be. And then it came around for the summer and they did the assignments and I was just stunned. I was not assigned to the kitchen. I mean, I was the best qualified person. How could this be? And when that happened, I realized, what was I doing over the last year? All, you know, because in the Zen monastery, you're actually eating, and you know, in meditation posture, you're kind of sitting, meditating while you eat, and you know, there's good things to, you know, and I wasted all this time kind of fantasizing and planning for the summer. I could have been meditating. That was kind of, you know, a little bit embarrassing to realize, what was I doing? Planning for a future that never happened. So we sit, you know, so sometimes it takes a while to learn, but sooner or later we tend to see, what am I doing? This begins to feel not like, you know, not like real. It's like this, you know, virtual reality that I'm living in. And it starts feeling kind of dry to have these fantasies and thoughts over and over again. You start feeling at some point a disconnect between something real and living and these kinds of thoughts and what we're doing. And it can feel tiring. If you're really sensitive, you start feeling the stress it has in our body, the way it affects our muscles and our energy. And kind of the way it actually, even though it can feel intimate and engaged, some of these thoughts and concerns, it's really kind of, you can start feeling how it's really separating you from your life and from yourself. It's kind of like, you know, just kind of a very narrow part of the life, even though it might be a lot of energy there. It's you know, and they talk about, you know, being up in one's head and being disconnected with oneself. And so start feeling that as part of the wisdom, part of the understanding. It's not a bad news to see that. It's actually very helpful to realizing how much we're lost in thought and the cost of it and the effect on it. And it's not that interesting. There's more interesting things to do. Richer, more valuable, more something. And that can be the beginning of kind of not no longer believing in the value of it, no longer investing so much importance in it. It's hard to stop all those thoughts and concerns, but it's a big step to no longer, you know, invest all of our energy, all our thoughts, all our sense of importance, and this is of highest value to be engaged in these kinds of ways. And that kind of beginning to step back from it or not invest in it begins to kind of take away the fuel that keeps it going. And then at some point it becomes easier to actually say, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to do that anymore. I'm going to stop. I want to be here. And so we start showing up here. And that busy, that thinking mind, wandering mind begins to quiet down. And the analogy for this that I think of is that of a bowl, large bowl. And there was in some museums I used to take my kids to, kind of kid museums, they used to have these large bowls, really large bowls. And they would, kids would put marbles in them, drop marbles off the edge. And the marbles would either spin around and around, or they would spin down and up to the other side and back and forth. And it was really fun to watch, and you know, and there was a hole in the middle, and they would just eventually it'd go round and around and around, and it had to be spinning slow enough to fall into the hole in the middle, because you can go right over the hole without falling in if it had enough momentum. And sometimes they did coins. I guess that's the way a museum made money. But little marbles. And so our minds, our hearts are kind of like that, that we have these loose marbles in there. And, you know, they're kind of like just, you know, they're up and down and around, they're spinning around, and, you know, and it's kind of interesting to see how they spin, how they go up and down, and because you can spend a few years fascinated by it. And if you go into the bowl and push the marble, you give more momentum, it's going to keep spinning. And so you can watch and be very careful, and every time it gets slows down, it looks like it's going to fall in the hole, you hit it, and it spins it some more, and spins it. You can spend a lifetime keeping it going, going. But if you stop pushing it, the nature of gravity and the ball and everything, it's going to slow down. And if there's no hole at the middle, it'll finally come to rest at the middle of the bowl. If there is a hole, it'll come almost to rest, and then it'll drop away. And so, you know, the thinking and thoughts are kind of like the marbles. And as they start to quiet down, the mind begins to quiet and settle and come to rest. Similarly with emotions. Emotions can seem very important, can seem ultimate for some people. This is what's really important. Because me, myself, is important, and how I feel is important. And so, and how I feel is measured by how I'm emoting. And so there's sometimes a lot of investment into the importance and value of emotions, whether difficult emotions or good emotions. There can be very little equanimity about it all, but a lot of investment, a lot of preoccupation, a lot of negotiation and trying to adjust and fix and make better our emotional life. And that's the marble that some people are negotiating. And there also, it's easy to keep them spinning and going. But, you know, after a few, you know, periods of time, you know, caught up in anger, or caught up in desire, or joy, or happiness, or all kinds of things, they start losing some of their ultimate value. Some people, when they first experience meditative joy, it's like, wow, this is the best, and but after a while, meditative joy starts to kind of, you know, it's kind of tiring. You know, give me a break. And it's kind of hard to believe if you never experienced it, but, you know, it's like, if you're only at the first time you've ever experienced, like, how could this is the best thing going. I want to live here forever. But after a while, oh, give me a break. And anger, you know, give me a break, as opposed to kind of believing in it and negotiating everything through it. So after a while, emotions, they're important. Emotions are important parts of our life, crucial parts of our life. But to believe in them and invest in them and constantly negotiate them and define ourselves by them can be exhausting. And to not live for our emotions or because of our emotions or with our emotions is the primary thing, helps those marbles settle, come to rest. And we sit here and meditate, and we become aware of our bodies. And for many of us, when we first sit down, the bodies are uncomfortable in some way. Still, after all these years, when I sit down sometimes, like in the beginning of retreat or sometimes beginning of my meditation, I get to see the tensions that have built up in the course of my daily life, that, you know, just whatever I'm doing. You know, there's often a little bit of tension in doing it, like being at the computer and a little bit tight working at the computer and driving and talking and all kinds of things kind of build up in little muscles all over my body. And I don't even know about it until I sit down to meditate. And I say, oh, look at that. And sometimes it's more, and sometimes it's less. But look at that, you know, I'm just holding. And then as I sit with it, it tends to relax and unwind and settle down, and the body gets more tranquil, more relaxed and soft. And so the physical marbles begin to come more to rest and settled. And over time, it's possible for all the loose marbles to stop being loose, but to kind of come together and come to rest, and or come into themselves, just to be. And because one of the things that happens when we're caught up in the world of aboutness and thoughts, if we're too invested and over-involved with emotions, and if we're too disconnected to our body to let it settle, we can't really be ourselves. We can't really find how to be at peace and settled with who we are. And this is partly why I think samadhi is so sacred for me, so special, because it's a way for each of us to be ourselves fully. We're not trying to be some spiritual athlete, meditative athlete who goes into, you know, great, powerful states for their own sake, athletic state. But rather, we are trying to find out how to live in this life free. The freedom where our heart is not constricted or caught or afraid, or where our minds are at peace, where we're at peace with ourselves, where we can be ourselves fully. And each of us is unique. Each of us is a gift. Each of us is wonderful. Each of us is special. Each of us has our own uniqueness. So what is that? And how can we honor and respect and celebrate each of us? So how can we, and you know, what voices have you heard that tells you you're not special, not wonderful? What have you learned from your society and your religions and your families and that somehow has undermined your ability to feel comfortable and at ease and settled here as a human being, so that you can breathe easily and at ease, so that your mind can be at ease and content without the voices of I'm not good enough, or I'm terrible, or I need to be different, or so what does it take? So we have this capacity, this potential to come to a deep settled fullness, or a deep peacefulness, or a deep wholeness, or a deep sense of integrity, or a deep sense of being at home. I don't know what, you know, these are all ways of talking about it. I don't know what resonates with you. Maybe you have your own words for this. But a deep, I like the word at home. Deep sense of being at home here in this world. And what are the conditions to support that? What do we have to work through, and what reconciliation do we have to do? What do we have to understand or resolve, or what do we have to face about ourselves? What do we have to admit and be honest about to really allow this, eventually, this, you know, to do this path, this sacred path, wonderful path of, oddly enough, becoming yourself. And becoming yourself so thoroughly that self-preoccupation falls away. Because it turns out that self-preoccupation is more aboutness, is more kind of centrifugal force away. The other day I talked about patience. And I like to think of, there's two kinds of patience. There's patience which is something you do, and patience which is a non-doing. So two people are in the same trying circumstance, and they both look really patient. And you ask one of them, you're so patient, what are you doing? This one says, oh, I'm biting my tongue, I'm gritting my teeth, I'm just, you know, breathing deeply so I don't get reactive. It's a lot of work to be patient. And the person is patient, they're not. The other person says, patient? I'm not patient. I don't have any buttons that get pushed. The situation doesn't, you know, there's no stress in the situation for me. I'm not, you know, all my buttons have been removed long ago, triggers, you know, so. And so the situation is, the person looks patient, but the person's patient because nothing is agitating. So this idea of becoming yourself, there's also two ways. One way is, you know, in a way that kind of you can actively do yourself and become something. But the other possibility, which I think is more profound, is a non-doing. You really become yourself. You're allowed to be yourself completely, but you're so completely yourself that it's kind of like you disappear. I don't know if it's a good analogy, but it's kind of like I hope it's okay to say this, but something like, you know, no one has an accent. It's the other people have accents. Those other people have accents, but, you know, I just speak the way people are supposed to speak. Because there's, you know, often you feel that way because, you know, you get habituated, you think that how you speak is how speaking is supposed to be done. And I'm Norwegian, and so I didn't spend a lot of time in Norway, but enough time. But a lot of that time there was with living with my grandparents. And so I learned Norwegian, they're Norwegian. It was a primary way, and I didn't do much school there. I didn't hang out with a lot of Norwegian kids, so I wasn't on the street learning the latest, greatest way of speaking Norwegian. And when I went back to live in Norway, I think I was 20, and by that time I was a long-haired hippie. And I went to live Norway had hippies, and they had communes, and so I went to live in these Norwegian communes, and the Norwegians couldn't believe, where does that come from? Because it turned out that my grandparents were a little bit kind of upper class, you know, old school, and they spoke the equivalent of Victorian English. And, of Norwegian. So I would go and start, you know, this hippie, you know, like, let's have a joint, right? But but I would say it, you know, and, you know, I don't know, has thou a joint? I don't know. I didn't know what was, you know. So anyway, no one has an accent. So the idea that you're so at home, so comfortable, it's so normal to be yourself, that you can just kind of like, you know, it's like you're actually no one, because you don't have to prove yourself or do anything, or you don't have to be involved in defining yourself or defending yourself or apologizing for yourself. You can just be. And other people just have to deal with it. Anyway, you can just settle. So this is settling. So samadhi. So a lot of what we discover in sitting also is how much we're involved in selfing. Me, myself, and mine. And it's kind of embarrassing. At least I hope it's embarrassing for you that how much most of our thoughts, you know, are self-centered. It's me, myself, and mine are the main character. You know, it's all kind of referring back to oneself often. And even if we're talking about other people and doing other things for the world, it's, you know, who's the main character? You know, me, myself, and mine. It's more marbles, me, myself, and mine. And to have that settle down, at least sometimes, to have the opportunity to take a vacation from all that, is one of the most profound things to do in this life. To discover who we are when we don't have to be anything, because it all kind of, all the centrifugal forces, all the agitation, all the concerns, all the preoccupation, wanting and not wanting, all the dissatisfaction, all the conflict has settled down. And so there are no more curtains over our hearts, no more estrangement from ourselves, but we're kind of come here, we settle into ourselves, we relax into ourselves. All the ways in which we're not relaxed, which is, you know, a way of being separated from ourselves, abates, and we're here, just here. And it's not like there's any then future and past, it's just here. It's not like there's something we have to get or want, we're just here. It's not like we have to think about anything. Thinking kind of recedes in the background, we're just here. And it's not like there's a world beyond our senses. Of course there is, but we're just so here, just here in this world, of this sense experience here. And now we're entering into the world of samadhi, of jhana, just here for this, and settling just here. Just breathing. Just being, in the way where the word just, wonderful word just in English, is a sacred word. Just breathing. Just sitting. Just walking. Just hearing. Just sound. Just thought. Just sensation. And then there's this freedom, this letting go of all these constrictions, all this stuff. And then there's a deep inner wellspring of vitality, a deep inner wellspring of well-being, of goodness, that can begin to flow. That's no longer restricted or held back or judged or prevented. And I think it's an amazing thing that we have these psychophysical systems here, that human life is so beautiful, that if we can get out of the way of ourselves and just really be here, that how much goodness flows. Love, compassion, joy, vitality, life. The Buddha talked about part of this vitality as being like a mountain lake, clean, pure mountain lake, that is not fed by rivers coming into it, and there's no rain that comes into it. It's only fed and nourished by underwater spring that comes from the underneath the lake and comes up into the lake. And it comes and fills the lake from the inside. And this idea that deep in our hearts, deep in our being, come this wellspring, come flow out, that can't really flow out if we're not settled and here and present. If we're spinning out in concerns. And what is it that wells up? It's kind of mysterious and marvelous. And perhaps some of it's unique to each of us. What inspires us? What our joys are? What our motivations are? And what our unique ways are? How we want to live in the world, or what we're curious about, what we're interested in, what comes. So this path of samadhi, one path to it, is not a path of turning away from anything, but to really see and sense and feel and experience this moment, this life, fully here. And then starting to see the shortcomings of some of the things we're invested in, some of the things we're doing that keeps us spinning and keeps the marbles keep going, and start really feeling, not judging it as being bad, but start seeing that it's tiring. Start seeing that I think I've been doing this long enough. There are people who have been running the same three tunes, same three concerns, for in their minds for decades. Goes on and on. There's reviewing the same thing, thinking about the same thing, wanting the same things, always being afraid, always anxious. It's okay to have a vacation. It's okay not to always be anxious. It's okay not always to be thinking. It's okay not always to be self-preoccupied. So to be really present and see and feel the cost and experience the impact of how we are, and then beginning to kind of say, okay, I don't want to do it anymore. Let me step back. Let me relax. Let me not believe in this anymore. And settle and quiet down and allow the wholeness that's there waiting for you to reclaim itself, to reappear. There is tremendous beauty and value in each of you. No one should ever say that you're lesser than, or unworthy, or wrong, or bad, or it's really to, there's so much wonderfulness in each person that's waiting and waiting and waiting, sometimes waiting a long time, to finally have a chance to bubble up and surface, to flow up. So samadhi, dhyana, deep state of absorption into just being yourself, just being here with this being, and the uniqueness of how this person is, but so deeply absorbed or so deeply settled into here, this person, that there is deep peace and well-being. That even the sense of self disappears. Just here. And I hope that as we kind of get a sense of this possibility and this way of coming at home in our own hearts, that we also then appreciate that this is a potential that others have, everyone has, and that we live our lives not just for our own sake of deep peace and well-being, but it becomes important for us that we support our society, our world, and others, so they can feel safe, they can be appreciated, so they can also kind of put to rest or relax what's anxious for them or dissatisfying for them or challenging for them, so they also can taste and touch this deep wellsprings of peace and joy and well-being, compassion. So that what's of ultimate value is this deep absorption into just being here. Dhyana Paramita. So let's sit for a moment.